And what we're going to do is get back into some quantum mechanics and look at that, and look at what this theory says. So remember, yesterday we looked at the double slit experiment. So again, this very, very crucial experiment, we have an electron or an electron gun that's emitting a whole bunch of electrons, a whole stream of thousands of them out from here. And we have some kind of a wall, two holes or two slits up there. And what we can see, if we have, as long as the gun's not too hot, we can see a wave-like pattern. This wave is sinusoidal pattern, which is essentially exactly what we get when we do the experiment with classical water waves. It's analogous to that. So that leads us to think that electrons have a wave in us, some wave-like aspect. And as I said before, what we can do, you can even send through one electron at a time, a single electron flux, and you still see that pattern. And so what this leads us to is something that is very, very crucial, a very fundamental part of quantum mechanics, and it's called superposition. And the idea is that in some sense, it seems as if the electron appears to be taking, each individual electron is going through both slits at the same time. Certainly it acts as if it is going through both slits at the same time. And so that is one example of this notion of superposition. And superposition, just generally, you can have superpositions again with classical waves, just a superposition of one possibility and another, or one wave configuration and another configuration. And here we have the superposition, or kind of two things at once, the electron motion through the top slit and through the bottom slit. And you get superposition all throughout quantum mechanics, all kinds of ranges of errors in various techniques, and certainly for quantum computers, it's a very, very crucial part of those and how they work. So that's the idea of superposition. One thing that you might want to do is think, well, if we put through 1,000 electrons and half of them go through the top slit and half of them go through the bottom slit, can we actually look at, say, the 541st electron and try and predict which slit it will go through and actually try and see if there's anything that distinguishes or is different between the electrons that go through the top slit and those that go through the bottom slit? Turns out the answer to that is no. On these electrons that are going through as they come out, and there doesn't seem to be anything, any difference fundamentally between the electrons going through the top slit and the electrons going through the bottom slit. They seem to be identical apart from the fact that they go through different slits. And so what that leads you to think is that you can't predict which, say, the 541st electron or the 975th, which slit it will pass through. There seems to be a genuine randomness or an intrinsic randomness about it in terms of which slit the electron will go through. And you find that, again, running throughout quantum mechanics and this sort of indeterminism or randomness. So in a sense, quantum mechanics is like a casino. There seems to be this fundamental, hardwired into reality and into nature at a fundamental level, this randomness. So there are two key properties. And they turn up in the Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, which we'll go over to now. So as I said, what we're trying to do and what we'll see is that measurements are a very slippery, tricky business at the quantum level. And normally they're very, very invasive. They kind of mess up or disturb or interfere with whatever you're trying to measure. So again, we have an electron. And what we'd like to do is to measure exactly where that electron is and how fast it's moving. And what we'll find is we necessarily, as I said, disturb it. So if we want to find out where it is, we need to interact with it somehow. We need to bounce something off. We need to have some kind of connection with it. And so what we might do is just to shine a torch. You can think of a torch or a laser beam here. What we're doing is some light source. We're just shining that onto the electron. And if we do that, we can think of light. You can think of light as a wave. And so we might have light of a single frequency, frequency f, and we have sort of incident wave, just a plain wave there coming in frequency f and wavelength lambda. And so what we have is that incident on the electron there, and we saw that all entities, quantum electrons, have a wave-like nature to them and a particle-like nature. Well, it turns out that light and all quantum entities have that. So light has a waviness aspect to it and a particle-like nature. And because of that, we can think of light as the incident light as not being a wave coming through like a water wave. We can think of it as a stream or a shower of particles, like tiny pebbles that were all throwing or coming towards the electron there. And so each of those, as we know from this formula here, it has a wavelength, well, associated with it that's given by h divided by p. And so as a result, the momentum of each of these particles, these photons that we talk about, they have a momentum of p equals h divided by lambda. So that's kind of exactly like sort of showering this electron with sort of a string of particles all of momentum p. And so obviously what's going to happen is the greater the momentum, the more intense or the stronger or the faster these photons are going, well, I guess they go at the speed of light, but the more momentum they have, then what happens is the more bark, the more disturbed the electron. We're going over to the next page. What we can see there is a scattering experiment. So this is very much like two tennis balls scattering off each other or a tennis ball scattering off a rock. It's a sort of particle-particle collision. So here we have the collision and the recoil of the electron. And the interesting thing about that is that collision will have kind of a random nature to it. You won't be able to predict where the electron will go, which direction it will be bounced or recoiled off into. So as a result, you lose some information. There's something that you're lacking about the momentum of the electron. And what we can find is, turns out that say we wanted to find out, make this collision or make this recoil momentum or our loss of information about the electron as small as possible, what we would try and do is just use a single photon. So we just bounce a single photon off an electron. Because obviously doing any more, we'll just disrupt or interfere with the electron even more and know even less about it. So if we have just a single photon here of momentum p coming in, then it turns out what we do know or what we lose or what we're unable to know about the electron, its momentum, we can summarize that by delta p. So that's the uncertainty in the momentum of the electron. So what we know don't know about. That's all due to the fact that we're bouncing, in this case, one photon off the electron. And as a result, what happens is the uncertainty of momentum, it's roughly of the order of the same magnitude as the momentum of the incident photon. So I guess in the extreme case, what I should say, what we're interested in now, I talk about the position and momentum of the electron, but what we are interested in is just in that, in the x direction. So the direction, I guess, horizontally along the page there. So when I talk about the position, it's the position, I guess you might think of an x coordinate or an x direction along the horizontally along the page, and that's looking at the momentum and the position we're looking at. So it's just a one-dimensional problem we have here. And so what we find is that probably the extreme case would be if the electron went, I guess, in the same direction as the incident photon. So the photon gave up all its momentum in that direction, the x direction, to the electron, and it came and went, I guess, towards the right of the screen, to the right of the page, and what would happen would be that we would have a momentum of that, or of being added by h divided by lambda. And the other extreme case, perhaps, is just a glancing, well, it's a very solid blow, and the electrons recoiled vertically down, or close to that, then it will have very little or close to no momentum in that direction horizontally across the page. And so therefore, in between the extremes, I guess, of p of h divided by lambda and zero, that gives us, roughly speaking, I guess, an order of for the momentum or the uncertainty of momentum of the electron. So that's how little we know about it. And so we can, as I said, minimize that. So again, we want to measure the momentum of the electron. And I should say, we, I guess, get information about the momentum of the electron by knowing where the light, I guess, or whether the photon actually gets bounced up into the microscope that we have. So again, there's the microscope above. Some light goes into the objective lens of that, then into the eyepiece. And through that, we see the microscope, we see the electron, in a sense, by seeing the light that's coming through to the top. And so what we do find is that if we actually increase the wavelength, so make the wavelength of the incident photon larger, then obviously we decrease delta p, the uncertainty in the momentum of the electron. So we're increasing this here, and we actually decrease it. So what we want to use is light of a very, very low frequency. It's high wavelength, low frequency. That's what we want. And so that's what we want to do. So we'll basically make the light of, I guess, redder and redder, so lower and lower frequency to actually minimize the disturbance. So that's what happens with momentum. So what we want is a very low, large, high wavelength. So let's look at the position. We said that Heisenberg's uncertainty principle that relates uncertainty into position and the momentum of the electron. We've looked at the momentum, so now let's turn to the position. What we find is, going over to the next page, we have microscopes. So these all look through a microscope. You know what it is to look through a microscope. And what we find, what we see, is we see an eyepiece. So essentially, let's assume that it's circular. And we might find some object that could be a virus, could be a bacterium, whatever it is. We're looking at some kind of tiny particle. And we see that just within the eyepiece of the microscope. And we have, I guess, grades there or that tell us whereabouts the position of the object is located. And the grid lines give us information about that. So what happens if we keep making the magnification of the microscope larger and larger, and we keep trying to find out more information, get more and more information, and get more of an idea about where the particle is, in this case, where the photon is. Then we might think, well, do we actually come down and get a larger and larger point here, or object, as we increase the magnification? Well, it turns out we don't. And there's a very, very fundamental limit that's given by something called the Rayleigh criteria for finding out, I guess, distinguishing and being able to get information or sort of a resolution of a microscope down to a small level. And if you have light coming from the microscope a wavelength lambda, then the maximum resolution you can get, I guess the maximum or the smallest distance between two points that you can distinguish between is roughly the same size or the same magnitude as the wavelength of what you're trying to see. And so if you try to look at an object that's smaller than that, or actually that's actually just a point by interacting light with it, then you actually don't see a point on the grid. You actually see this fuzzy ball here, or disk, and that's called an Aries disk. And the reason you actually see that, is because of diffraction, due to diffraction. That you're essentially, the light's coming into the microscope, and essentially just as light, after it goes through a small slit, spreads out and diffracts out. What happens with the light that comes in here? Again, it spreads out as it goes from the objective to the eyepiece. And so this spreading out, or this diffraction, inevitably fuzzes out in some sense of pattern. You don't see a sharp point. Even the object you might be trying to look at is just a point, or very, very small. So this gives you a fundamental limit. And it turns out that roughly, that's given by a delta x, or a delta position. So again, I guess we have the position over here. Along this horizontal axis gives an idea of the position of the electron. And if we don't know it to within any closer or any smaller than a wavelength, and then we have a position or a delta x of lambda there. And it turns out that if we as far as we know, electrons are point particles. So that's why I was talking about point particles before. We think that an electron, at least as far as we've been able to investigate, down to the scale we have, it's at least definitely much smaller than the radius or the radius of a nuclei. And so what we do find is, looking here, that within this disk here, if we just have a single photon, bounce a single photon off the electron, and it comes into this eyepiece here, what we do find is that we just get a random dot, a random click of the photon at any point within this disk here, this area disk. And so if we have lots and lots of photons, very high intensity beam, we can build up or get all at once this disk or this fuzzed out pattern as a result of electron diffraction. But if we actually look at decreasing the flux, so sending just one photon in at a time, we build it up by random dots here, or random, I guess, interactions or points or clicks anywhere in this disk of seeing photons. But you might think, well, if we see a photon at this point halfway from the center of the radius or the disk, that might tell us that the electron's exactly there. Well, it turns out that it doesn't. There's no definite or no normal, I guess, no definite link between where exactly in the point of this radius here or this circle you see the electron or see the photon, and and where the position of the electron. There's actually no definite length. There's just a random once you're in this disk here. And so if this disk or this has a diameter of delta x, then that gives us or sets some kind of a scale for the uncertainty, the delta x uncertainty of the position in the x-axis, x-direction of the electron. Going on to the next slide. So what we thought we'd do, we try and disrupt and disturb the electron as little as possible. So we just use one photon. Just got one photon and bounce a single photon off it. And so that leads to a momentum just given by the momentum of the photon that causes the recoil of the electron. So that's h divided by lambda. And again, if we have one photon of wavelength lambda coming through into the microscope, then it will spread out due to diffraction. So in a sense, we can think of it spreading out, and that will give us an uncertainty position of lambda. So the larger the wavelength, the greater the uncertainty in position. And so what we do find, the interesting thing is that there, so the uncertainty position, the wavelength appears in the numerator. The larger the wavelength, the larger the uncertainty. But the larger the wavelength, but the uncertainty or the wavelength appears in the denominator for delta p. So in that sense, there's an inverse relationship. The larger the wavelength, the smaller the uncertainty. So if we multiply those two together, h divided by lambda multiplied by lambda, to find out the product of the two uncertainties, what we end up with is h. So h is this fundamental constant, as I said before, Planck's constant. And Lee talked about h bar before, and so I think h bar is up there, but h bar is just h divided by 2 pi. So it just turned out to be a very, very useful relation or very useful variable in quantum physics. And so what we find is this is what the uncertainty is in this case. And it turns out this is actually the best you can do. Fundamentally, you can always get more uncertainty. You can always know less information. You can do some very, very clumsy way of trying to find out where the electron is and measure the electron. And you would find out the uncertainty. The product of the two uncertainties would be a lot more, but you can never actually beat that limit. And so contrary to Newtonian physics, you can think of a large everyday object. You can measure its position as accurately as you want to, at least in Newtonian, according to Newton. And you can measure its momentum as accurately as you want to. There's no fundamental limit. But what this high-limit uncertainty principle seems to be saying is just hardwired into nature. It's kind of as if nature isn't telling us or it doesn't allow us to find out everything about a particle. It doesn't allow us to find out everything that we ought to be able to know or we think we should be able to know. And we can actually kind of formalize it a bit more and by showing that the uncertainty, so this is Heisenberg's uncertainty relation. And this tells us that the uncertainty of the position of the particle multiplied by the uncertainty momentum is greater than or equal to h bar divided by 2. So we have h bar is h divided by 2. So again, this is fundamental for that no matter, if you could have the best equipment in the world, the best experimentalists in the world, no matter how good they are, you can't beat this limit. And it doesn't seem to be as a result of just bad experimentalists or clumsy experimental techniques. What it seems to be is hardwired into nature, fundamental thing. So it's a very, very strange thing. And so as it says up there, it has nothing to do with imperfections or practical in the construction of apparatuses or just the way that we're doing it. It's not because our machines or devices or microscopes don't have perfect mirrors. Even if you assume that, you get the Heisenberg's uncertainty relationship. And so I guess the standard way of thinking about it is actually not quite as we've done it with a different emphasis, but the standard way of thinking about it is as a statistical thing. Most of the experiments, really all of the experiments in quantum physics, they're statistical things, so you have probabilities. So just as if you want to experimentally find out probability of getting heads or tails when you toss a coin 1,000 times, and you build up statistics. So that's generally what people do in quantum physics. So they experiment again and again with more and more electrons, or whatever their particles are, and they build up this information. So one natural way, or step further, is, and certainly a number of people have, it's not only that we can't measure what the position and momentum of an electron is simultaneously, but it just doesn't have it. So then electrons, they just simply don't have simultaneous positions and momenta. And so, as an example, if you exactly know where a particle is, you exactly know the position of it, then some people say the quantum mechanics says then it just doesn't have a momentum. The momentum is completely undefined. There's just no fact of the matter about which the momentum is and which velocity it has. So really that's the complete breakdown of the Newtonian view. Yeah. So one thing we'll skip the page there. Just briefly, we'll look at this more on Monday. But it turns out that you might think, well, this is kind of a strange particle or a strange effect. And what impact does it have on me? What effect does it have? Well, it turns out that I'll talk about one modern application of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. And so Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, I think to most people, it seems like it's something negative. That quantum mechanics, it just doesn't allow you to find out as much as we should be able to. We can't find out everything. But it turns out that we can kind of turn it around and actually has a positive use. And so for the last 20 or so years, physicists, actually a little bit longer than that, have known about this use and have actually found, and so this is actually commercially available now. So Heisenberg's uncertainty principle has a commercial application. And so briefly go, it'll be kind of hand-waving, but, and this is something called quantum cryptography or quantum secret coding. And it dates back to, well, it dates back originally to the 60s, but it was kind of rediscovered. But actually, someone came up with this in the 60s, but everyone just thought he was crazy and ignored him. That was named Stephen Deason. And it was rediscovered in 1984 by Charles Bennett and Giles Broussard. And this is quantum cryptography or quantum secret codes. And so cryptography is a multi-billion dollar industry. So there are a lot of people that will pay a lot of money to keep certain things secret. So these are bank account details, credit card details, obviously, and also the military as well. And so people are very, very interested in secret code systems and ways of keeping information secret. And there are a number of excellent codes around now, but none of them that are practically used are known absolutely to be 100% sure, guaranteed to be secure and uncrackable. And so wouldn't it be cool if there was some way we could use Heisenberg's uncertainty principle to help keep your password secret. So we can, and this is quantum cryptography. So as I said, there are probably half a dozen, at least two companies that I know around the world that actually sell these quantum cryptographic systems. And so if you have a spare $70,000 lying around, you can buy one of these to help keep things safe and secure. And there's two websites, two companies, Magic in New York City and ID Quantique in Switzerland, I believe. It sells that, and they rely on Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. And so this is a very, very hand-wavy thing. We'll have to be going, the math is actually not that complicated. It's not too difficult, so we'll be going through that later on. But very roughly speaking, let's say you have a PIN or a PIN number. So if your bank account, you want to hide that. Let's assume it's just very, very simple. It's just 1234. You haven't, you know, been too careful about. So it's very, it's kind of silly PIN number, you know, you could easily find out someone pressing that in, but that's what it is. It's very easy to remember. So let's say we take an electron, what we want to do is somehow sort of hide that or encode that or write it down. And so we could take an electron and actually push it. So we have the momentum of 1,234 kilometers per second. Well, that's probably unrealistic. And so what we might do is maybe so it has a momentum of 1,234 kilogram meters per second. So I'll just turn maybe the lights down. Oops, is that better? Yeah. Much better. Okay, sorry about that. Okay, so it has a momentum of 1,234 by 10 to the, it should be a minus 25. Yep, minus 25 there it is, kilogram meters per second. And so in a sense, what we've done is we've encoded the information about pin number into the momentum. And so let's assume that Newtonian physics, Newtonian mechanics are true for the moment. Then what happens is people can just measure that. They can just measure either the position or the momentum of the particle, and they can find out our pin number. But in quantum mechanics, things are a little bit different. And so let's say someone doesn't know. Let's say we secretly encode the momentum or the information for momentum. then what happens is, imagine when someone's trying to sleep on your PIN number, and they don't know the PIN code information of the momentum, and they make it the position. If they make it the position, what happens is then they, just as we in the previous example, by throwing a light or a laser beam on it, what they do is actually mess up and disturb the momentum, so that they actually gain no information about the momentum. So they know exactly what the position is, or in general the momentum position to some accuracy, delta x, then necessarily they know the uncertainty of the momentum has to be at least h bar divided by a. And so that they, if they measure the position, then they won't, then there's no way they'll be able to find the momentum and find out the pin number. Now there's also kind of record for us. We won't be able to find it. No one does. It's lost forever. But at least you can see, I'm just trying to get across just the fact that there's a qualitative difference between the two cases. So at least in this case, your pin number is safe and the person doesn't have it. Yep.
I was just wondering.
So
you put your pin number into like
the ribbon of an
electron or something, because you forget things
is
like, how on earth would you retrieve your pin number?
Oh, but you mean how practically would
you measure
the position of the momentum of the electron? But if no one else can get it back, how can you get it back? Oh, right. Well, in that case, you have some extra information, so you know that you secretly encoded it in the momentum, so you know the measures of the momentum. Of that. So in this was just, I guess, the worst case scenario is that where someone didn't know, so someone came along and they just know there's an electron and they didn't know whether you put it in the position or the momentum, and they just made the wrong choice. So it's kind of, it's not really rigorous, but you can actually show basically what you do is by putting you can effectively set up the secret code by having a whole bunch of electrons, 100 electrons, and encoding positions for information either the position or the momentum, and then no one will be able to find that out without disturbing it. Okay. So what I'll turn the lights on and turn this off. And so what I think we've got scheduled to talk about is entanglement. So okay. Maybe I'll turn that off. So we'll just look a little bit at entanglement now for the next while. And so what I tried to get across was the essential core features of quantum physics. So what is the essence of quantum physics? Definitely this idea of superposition is that normally for classical particles, classical tennis balls, they have to go through either one slip or another slip. That doesn't seem to be the case at quantum level. We can have states of affairs where particles, electrons, go through both slips at the same time, or they're wave functions corresponding to with non-zero parts going through both slits. And we have this fundamental randomness, this intrinsic randomness. And what we find is that it seems it's hardwired in at the natural level. So what Erwin Schrödinger said, the essence, said that entanglement, something called entanglement, is the essence of quantum mechanics. And it's the defining characteristic feature of quantum physics. So we'll briefly have a look at that now. What people actually do in experiments, they have laser beams. So we have laser beam here, and they've shown this in particularly the types of crystals, such as calcite. What happens is those special properties, the nonlinear crystals, they can find that. About 99%, or over even more than that, something like 99.99% of the photons simply go straight through this crystal. And this is typically the size of, it's maybe about a centimetre by a centimetre by a centimetre. So it's very, very small crystals. But a lot of people have these in laboratories. But what you do find is you can think of a laser beam as matter, but there's billions and billions of photons. So it's a whole bunch of photons. Almost all of them go through, but there's a small chance that some of them will actually interact with the crystal. And what happens in that case is you get one photon that can go up You might have high energy photons, these are ultraviolet photons at a fairly high frequency. They interact with the crystal here, and they get absorbed by the crystal and then re-emitted. And what they get is re-emitted as two photons of a lower frequency, a lower energy, and that process is called down conversion. And so we get this happening in a very small percentage of cases, but photons are very cheap. You can make billions of photons, so it's very easy to get them here. There are lots of photons coming out of all the artificial light in this room. So we have, and what we want to do is just focus on these photons here. So when actually you can get individual photons, where you have one photon over here and one photon over there. And what they've been able to do is actually in Switzerland, probably one experiment, they did their ABAB, produced photons like this, and they sent one photon into a fiber optical cable. So again, I think you may have seen those at Wolf Laurier on Tuesday, but they're kind of like, they look like fishing wires. They're very, very small, very, very thin, sort of transparent cables. Yep.
Do they always come at the same angles? Like, is that how they kind of control?
Not exactly the same angles. They always come within a range of angles, but sometimes you always find the angles are coordinated, but it's normally it's sort of a window. So there's kind of a little range here they come out at, and a little range here.
So when they just say capture the photon with the fiber optic drive, just lock or?
It's basically it's a alignment thing. So what they do is they have the fiber optic cable. It might be just set up here so that a photon going in this direction will go in. Sure, there'll be some going out there, you'll miss those, but again, photons are cheap, so they just deal with the ones they keep. So basically, they just direct the photons that they go directly into. So if I drop the cable, basically how they do it. And then they had the fiber optical cable going for a long distance, it was about 6 or 7 kilometres, and that went off to one little village in Switzerland where they had houses made like this. And they had another fiber optic cable, and they said that, well, it's probably not really to scale, but to another little village, and they had houses. So what they did have was basically these two photons, and they're separated from each other by about 11 kilometers. So that makes this house about a kilometer wide, which is probably not very realistic, but you get the idea. So basically what I'm trying to say is they got these two photons and they're far away from each other. And because of the way they interact with each other in this very special way, this sort of down conversion process, so we get one high energy photon being absorbed, and that kind of emits, causes some electrons in the crystal, the calcite, to actually get excited. So a material absorbs photons, electrons in that get excited to higher energy states, and then what can happen is typically they re-emit, they go down to a lower energy state, a less energetic state, and what can happen is they actually do that kind of instant jump. So might have an intermediate, level 1, 2, 3, so the electron can jump up, photon coming in here, photon comes in, high energy photon, electron gets up excited, and then basically re-emitted, and we get the two photons. So I guess gamma is a symbol for the photon, and just gamma 1 again, two emitted photons. And basically, because of the nature of that interaction in here, what happens is that the electrons coming out in the fiber optical cables are what's called entangled with each other. So they're entangled with each other, and the property that they're said to have, they're said to share, is called entanglement. And so this is the thing. This is the thing that Schrödinger said back in 1935 is the characteristic defining trait of quantum physics. So this is where it's all at. And it's probably the weirdest thing about quantum physics. It's just the most bizarre, kind of strangest thing. So I will attempt to explain it to you now. And so there are a number of ways of looking at it. So we'll kind of look a bit more math later on. We'll do the hand waving stuff now. And so what happens is people in this experiment, they looked at the polarization of these photons, so how they were polarized. And so what do I guess you all, at least at some level, you know all about polarization. But well, we can think of photons or light as being made up of just vibrating or oscillating electric and magnetic waves. And for, I guess, so we can think of these photons as being, I guess, traveling in one direction here. So their light is a transverse wave. So we can think of this being made up as being one instant, I guess, an electric field there, and kind of, it's sort of hard to draw, but this is meant to be a horizontal plane, a magnetic field there, and these will typically oscillate. So we've got these, and what we have is if a photon is or light is polarized, then what we have is the electric field is just in one plane. So if it's vertically polarized, and what that corresponds to an electric field that's wiggling, essentially up and down, horizontally polarized, electric field wiggling horizontally. So that would be sort of in and out of the plane. So this is what they're looking at. This is what they measured for these photons here. And what quantum mechanics, what they found is that when actually, so in experiments, what they looked at is just the photons are the polarization just either measured horizontally or vertically. So whether that was sort of horizontally polarized, I'll call that H, or vertically polarized. And what they found, if they just looked at the polarization of one photon, so just look at the photon coming over here, then if they looked at 1,000 photons, they found it was totally random as to what the polarization is. It was 50-50. So for 1,000 photons, 500 of them, or vertically polarized, 500 horizontally polarized. And the other one, the same one. So is what quantum mechanics seems to be, so they're completely random. But what they did find is when they actually looked at, compared the results, so say from the first experiment and the second experiment, what they did find is the photons always had the same polarization. And so if this one over here was measured to be horizontal, then that one over there was measured to be horizontal too. And if this one was measured to be vertical, then the other one was measured to be vertical. So there was a perfect correlation, if you like. And so that led you to believe that that allowed physicists to be able to predict that if you knew what the polarization of one photon was, then you know certainly what the other one is. You know this one's V, you measure it, then you can know what that is and look at the other one. That's V. And so what quantum mechanics is strange, that might not seem so strange in itself, but what quantum mechanics says, if you actually look at the state or the state of affairs of quantum mechanics, the two photons coming out, is that it actually says that the photons don't have a definite polarization. That the state coming out of here is actually a superposition state, and the superposition state is V and V. So H and H and H and V and V. So what I mean by that is, if you actually look at the math of quantum physics, and what it says is that the photons come out and there's just no definite matter of fact about what the polarization or what about the polarization of individual photons is. So we normally think of a photon, we think, well, if we fully looked at it, it must be H or V. It must be some definite way. But what quantum mechanics says, just as we can have the superposition of electron not seeming to be able to go through any individual slip, but through both slips at the same time. So this says or suggests that what quantum mechanics is saying, if we take it at face value, is that just the electron, the photons don't come out when you take polarization, it's indeterminate. So they're both, either they're both horizontal, or they're actually the superposition states. So this is another example of superposition. So if we this kind of overlap in each other, two horizontal photons coming out of this crystal here, and at the same time, in some kind of nebulous sort of fuzzy state of affairs, they're both vertical and vertical. So it's kind of sort of two sort of possibilities, kind of, I guess, sort of superposed or superimposed upon each other, and that's the idea of a superposition. And so that's the state of affairs we have coming out. And so, but the interesting thing about that is, if, as soon as we measure one of the photons here, then we automatically know what, if we measure it to be vertical, we automatically know that the state is not this, but the photons are both vertical and vertical. And so obviously there's a, and so obviously each, then both photons have a definite state of affairs, they have a definite polarization there. So it seems as if they come out, and quantum mechanics tells us they come out, and before we looked at them, before we measured them, the polarization of each of them is indeterminate. It just doesn't have any particular value. It's, there's no sort of factor about the matter. It's not as if each individual photon comes out, or each individual pair, either definitely both horizontal, or they're definitely vertical. It's indeterminate. And after measuring, it becomes determinate and definite. And so one very natural way of looking at that and thinking about that is to say that what happens in the act of measuring this photon here and measuring its polarization has an instantaneous effect on this photon over here, and actually changes it, even though this is a long 11 kilometers away, and as far as quantum mechanics says, it could be over the other side of the universe. And it still seems to have an instantaneous effect by, in a sense, people talk about this as stuff like this as collapses the wave function. So the idea is that we have an instantaneous non-local effect by measurement here, affecting the state of affairs over there. And so what this would be like, this is the next, if we had the same thing happening with two dice, so imagine two dice, two 6-0 dice that you log, if you got an analogous effect happening with that, what you would have is, you could take two dice, I could hold one, keep one in my hand, give another one to you, you could take that into the next room, into the bistro, you could even take it back home with you. And what we would do is we would each roll our dice, each of the dices that we have, and we could roll them 100 times each, and what we find is they work perfectly normally, like dice do, and you know, 1/6 of the time they're all 1, 1/6 2, 1/6 3. But if we actually I guess roll them sort of in a coordinated way, we each roll them pre-planned times sort of together, or even not exactly together. So for example, I might, well, I guess, what we would find, well, I guess we'd have to have lots and lots of dice. So if we have a game, so we have sort of a pocket, we have sort of a whole bag of dice, I have 100, I give you 100, and what we would find, if I roll the first one and you roll the first one, we'd find that we always come up with the same number. So it would be, I would get a 1, and you would get a 1, you'd pick the second die, the dice out, and I would roll, we would both roll them, I would get a 2, you would get a 2, and we'd get the third one out, and no matter what, I would get a 6, you would get a 6. So, no matter how many times we roll them, we would get these perfect correlations. And these perfect correlations exactly mirror and are exactly the same as the correlations that we have here. And so the idea is that in that case, it's natural to think that there's some kind of connection or mechanism somehow by which kind of the dice can communicate to each other. And certainly this is a natural way of thinking about what's happening here. And so another way of looking at that entanglement is two different ways. There's actually a world expert, Anton Zeiner, I talked to you about. He looked at the electron diffraction experiment. I've heard when he gives popular talks on entanglement, He talks actually about entanglement and says, even though you kind of, there's a sort of gesture, and he says, you know, we've got these two photons and they're entangled with each other, and he kind of sort of locks his arms like that. And kind of that, whenever he does that, that gesture kind of speaks to me. And so in some kind of sense, I have this idea that you have these two photons that are very far apart from each other, but in some sense, they're still very much connected to each other. And another way of looking at the hand-wavy way is to say that even though that kind of an entanglement is in a sense where sort of the left hand knows what the right hand is doing, even though both hands are far apart. But what we'll actually do now is get on to a bit of mathematics. And
David?
Yep.
How is polarization determined, or is it just random?
How do you measure it practically, or how?
I mean,
well, quantum mechanics says it's random. Says you mean, like, how does each photon know whether to be horizontal or vertical? Is that what you mean?
Well, I guess, but even just one photon, how is what makes them different?
Right. It's basically the orientation of the electric field. So if the electric field is kind of wiggling or oscillating in a horizontal plane, because again, you think of light and photons as being made up of electrically magnetic fields. So horizontally polarized just means there's electric fields oscillating or wiggling in the horizontal plane and vertical plane. So that's physically, that's, yeah. Yep.
Just got a couple of things. When you get photons out of the calcite and they go to the different places, you said, like a certain percentage comes out, so more than one pair
come
out? Is that right?
It depends on, yeah, normally more than one pair. What they do is they do it in thousands and thousands of pairs. So they have a laser beam, and that typically, they have something like maybe a 1 milliwatt laser, and that has beams of photons. Yeah.
How do you know which pairs belong with each other? Like, if you've got this whole stream of electrons coming
along. Yeah, that's a good point. What happens, it just turns out, because most of them go through, it's, in a sense, it's very, very highly unlikely that you get two photons or two pairs coming out at the same time. So that if they get two coming out and they measure them at the same time, then it's most likely there's some chance, but it's, you know, 0.0001, that they'll actually be sort of two different pairs at the same time. So that's, it doesn't sort of work perfectly, but it's, that sort of what an error to the minimal error to it. So yeah, so this is a bit kind of weird. It's all kind of probabilistic, but this is the way they do it.
Sorry,
yeah.
Just one more thing. The two spiders that go to the different places, are they the same
thing? I'm not sure actually, but I think they're probably roughly the same length. So, yeah. I mean, most of the experiments are done in a lab. This was actually an extreme one. So most are done with a huge big table, what they call an optical bench. You'll see some of those at the Institute for Quantum Computing. But, yeah, this one was, they just wanted to see how far they could do it. And some people are actually planning these experiments in space at the moment, where you actually get, I think, two satellites and you get about 1,000 kilometers apart. And you just get photons being sent just in deep space to one and to the other one. Ross?
When you're measuring the polarization, how do you know which way is vertical and which way is horizontal?
Well, that's just by the standard convention that we know horizontal. You just set up some prior convention. We just use the standard one that we both agree now that horizontal is that way and vertical is that way. So they just kind of use the standard convention for direction.
Like relative to the ground?
Relative to the ground. So, and they just, that's, you know, that's something that they just use the everyday convention. But they could, yeah, I mean, they do have to agree upon. So if this was in space, this would be a problem, because where's horizontal and where's vertical in space? And so if they did this in deep space, what you actually have to do is actually have to set up, and they have to agree beforehand, yes, this is a vertical direction, or the direction pointing towards, see that distant star way over there, that direction is what we'll call the vertical direction or the horizontal direction. So that, yeah, actually that's kind of a deep point that people only recently realized, you actually need to set up a horizontal vertical direction or a reference frame. Yes.
It should be polarized.
Sorry?
But it should be polarized.
You mean As the onward. Well, if you do that, that will affect the perfect correlations. You can still have them, but it might mean that instead of both of them always being horizontal, or both vertical, one's horizontal, one's vertical, and the other one, they have opposite polarization instead of having the same one. But I think they actually do that in some of the experiments where they actually get a halfway plate, and actually it changes polarization. So you can do that, it just changes the correlations around them being both the same. Okay, so some math. So this is how you might find entanglement presented in a popular science book. But if you look at a quantum mechanics textbook, it was kind of very different to that. And so what we can find is actually that if we just look at the polarization of a photon, then that's actually represented by the state of it by vectors. So Frederick looked at vectors and vector spaces, and the polarization of the photon is just represented by a vector. So so it's very simple, just a two-dimensional column vector. We'll call it A1 and A2 here. So that's a column vector. So it's a two-dimensional vector, a two-dimensional basis. So the two distinct states of affairs are normally the basis vectors, so you know the unit vectors x and y, they're two distinct vectors that don't overlap with each other. And so horizontal and vertical polar relations, they don't overlap with each other, they're two distinct states of affairs. So not normally people, what normally people do is say, if we have a vertically polarized photon, that's represented by a vector of just one north like that. And so that is, you can think of that as being one basis vector, and you can draw. This two-dimensional vector space, and have, I guess how will we, what label we use for vectors? Little arrow there up the top. And so in a sense, these two polarizations, horizontal and vertical, they're two distinct polarizations, they're two orthogonal polarizations. So distance will represent them by two, some unit vectors in different directions. So horizontal and vertical there, this is what we have. And so what this corresponds to is, this is just a representation. Well, I guess this is just a matrix representation of this vector here, so we have 1, 0 for vertical, and horizontal, we just swap it around, we have 0, 1. Okay. So, what the one interesting thing about quantum mechanics, we can have, and which is kind of strange, is we can have individual photons that, well, one feature of quantum mechanics is we can have these superposition states. So we can have a photon, it doesn't definitely have to have to be either horizontally or vertically polarized, but it can actually be some superposition of horizontally and vertically polarized, and we can represent that by a vector here. I guess we need to normalize that for H plus B, so that's sort of the superposition of, again, another superposition state. And mathematically, you might represent it like that, which is 1-1. But typically what we do is we want to have these vectors sort of normalized, so they're just our unit vectors, so it's kind of everything's nice and neat. And so we just need to divide that by whatever it turns to normalize that.
Is it possible to have a partially polarized proton?
Absolutely, yeah. Well, that's a good question. Certainly you can have a partially polarized. I mean, most people talk about this in terms of beams, and certainly you can have a partially polarized beams where you have 1,000 photons that, you know, 70% of them might be horizontally polarized and 30% might be vertically polarized, so you can definitely have that. So an individual photon being partially polarized, I have to think about that one, but I certainly you can have something very much like that, definitely with a lot of photons, but an individual, individual photon, I tend to think not, but I have to think about that one. So I think there are only two distinct states, either horizontally, vertically polarized.
Well, in keeping with the other quantum mechanics stuff, wouldn't it be possible to have a superposition of those two states for a typical particle?
Absolutely.
So
yeah.
Would that qualify as being partially polarized? Like if you made a measurement, there's a 10% chance that...
But the interesting thing is so that would be something like this here, if it's sort of a 50-50 superposition of vertically and horizontally polarized, then it's actually polarized in another direction, which is halfway between vertical and horizontal, 45 degree direction. So in that sense, there is some direction where it's fully polarized, but another sense in which it's not from the horizontal point of view. The equal superposition of vertical and horizontal is fully polarized. Just moving on. Imagine we had two photons, so we want to go from representing one photon to two photons. And so if we have one photon that's represented by a common vector, a 2 by 1, what's two photons represented by? Well, in that case, you actually have to... get photon 1 and photon 2. And you actually need this sort of, Frederick may have introduced this, he may have not, but this is what's called the tensor product operation. So this is a special kind of matrix product. And so if you generally have an R1 by C1 matrix, so that's with R1 rows, C1 columns, and an R2 by C2 matrix, someone with R2 rows, C2 columns, then if you actually take the tensor product those two together, then that actually is the matrix which is R1 multiplied by R2 rows and by C1 by C2 columns. So you actually get a much bigger matrix in general. And so the kind of the rule for the tensor product operation maybe we'll just do it with 2x2 matrices. For the moment, we can fairly easily generalize. So we have A11, A12. Okay. Uh, and let's call this matrix B. And what we can do is, so what we get is a 4x4 matrix. So this, each of those has two rows, so 2x2 is 4, each has two columns, 2x2 is also 4, and that's actually equal to. So what we do is actually take the first element, the 1-1 element in the first matrix, and in some sense we multiply that by B, which is the entire matrix here. So it's a bit strange, we've got just a number multiplied by a matrix, but that's legitimate, and this is what is in kind of first quadrant, the first sort of four elements there. And we take the second one, second element, multiply it by the entire second matrix, and do the same for the other two elements. And we get this. And so what we need to do is, yep.
Is it like a conventional scalar multiplication?
Sorry?
Is it like a, just a scalar multiplication?
Yes, yeah, scalar in front of us matrix, so yeah. Yeah, and so if we sort of, so in a sense, so yeah, that's a good point. A, B, A11B is like A11 in front of B11, B12, B21, B22, so, okay. Like that. So if we expand all these out, we get and the last four elements. So hopefully everyone can you see that, Mark? Okay, great. So that's what we get in this case. And so that's to give you an idea just of the product operations. But and so what we want to do is actually apply it, and actually it's a lot easier than this, but we actually want to apply it just to two column vectors, which are 2x1. And so when we do that, what we do is just take the first element, and in a sense,
I was going to check the top right-hand line,
And so here we have two rows in each. So 2x2 is 4, so the tensor operation has 4 rows. Each has one column, 1x1 is 1, so we have one column for the final result matrix. And what we have is A11, or A1 multiplied by B1, and then A1 by B2. We just translate this matrix into the first element. And then the next one is A2 by B1 and A2 by B2. So this is, and this is what is used to represent, this is the state or state of affairs of two protons, or at least the polarization state of affairs of two protons. And so if we have a, So if we have two photons and they're both polarized vertically, so it's vertical and vertical, or so it's V and V, then what might happen to the combined state is just 1, 0. 1, 0 just means the vertically polarized photon, and 1, 0 here. And if we take the tensor product of that, we just get 1 and 1, 1 and 0, so that's 1, 0, and then we get 0 here, so this is what the final state is. And this final state, interesting enough, the final state that we have can be represented as just, I guess, the just the tensor product of one vector for the first photon multiplied, or tensor product with another vector for the second one. So, and you get a similar thing for horizontally, but it turns out if we have the state that we had before, the entangled state that I was talking about, that was horizontal and horizontal and plus sort of within a superposition with vertical and vertical. Like this. So if we're writing those out in terms of the vectors, what we find is maybe I'll get my go-to lines. So it's 0, 0, so 0 there, and 0, 1, plus 1. Okay. So we have 1. Okay. And what we might want to do is normally we normalize that. So it has a unit vector, and we get this for this state. And the interesting thing, and this is mathematically about entanglement, is that we had this just this state here. Obviously, there's a way to write as a tensor product of one state. Yep.
Why do you normalize it? What is that called?
That's actually because what it turns out is we want, it's really for probability reasons, because this is the mathematical object used to calculate probability. So maybe I didn't explain that clear in this case. So what you want is that, so we can write that as
one. You're basically saying that the probability is like 50% in your 1%.
Exactly. And we get those by, like, normally we get those by squaring that and squaring that to get the probability. So what we want this to do is to encode or just represent information about probabilities. And so as a result, we want, or I guess the probability, or the square roots of the probabilities, really. And so what we do if we have these and we square both of those elements, then that gives us a half and gives us a half, and that's the probability of finding this to be horizontal. Great. So that's okay. But the interesting thing about this state is it's what's called an entangled state, and the interesting thing about this is that there's actually no way to write it as, I guess, a tensor product of two states for each of these two systems. So for the first photon and for the second photon, in kind of any basis or sort of any two vectors. So, okay. So what that's saying is that where V1, V2, W1, W2. And we want that to try and equal one over root two, zero, zero, one over root two. And we have the condition, I guess, that, well, assuming we, these could be, well, I guess assuming we limit ourselves to real numbers, we don't necessarily have to, but V squared plus V1 squared plus V2 squared equals one, so that's the condition. And W1 squared plus W2 squared equals one is the other condition. And I guess the sort of V1, V2, at least in, this is certainly true. It's not going to complex numbers yet. I guess they're real numbers with that condition, so that there's actually sort of no way to write it in that form there. And so what we do find is that, so what that shows you is at a mathematical level, if we can write this state, this overall state with the two photons, you can sort of separate it out in a sense that we get a distinct, definite, well-defined state for the first photon, sort of multiplied or tensor product with, or some way put together with, a distinct, well-defined state for the second photon. Then, if there's, oops, I should put a, yeah, I should say that there's that, you know, basically you can try all the values from V and all the values to the V's and the W's you want to satisfy these conditions, and it turns out there's just no way of doing it. So there's no way for every entangled state, there's no way of kind of disentangling it, if you like, or separating it out into a state of affairs where you have one sort of separate state and another separate state. And so the way Schrodinger talked about this, he said, is though that even you might have these two photons, and you think we've got one photon here, another photon 11 kilometers away, surely there's a distinct photon here, and another distinct photon there, and there's two separate states of affairs. You know, they're miles apart from each other, so they must be, you know, two different entities. So Schrodinger says, well, quantum mechanics doesn't seem to say that's the case. And so the way he talked about it, he said there's a sense in which, even though they're incredibly, incredibly far apart, it's as if, I don't know, there's some invisible rubber band stretching between them. And so in some sense, even though they're far apart, they're actually a single entity. And there's no sort of definite state of affairs. You can't sort of say we have photon one and then there's photon two. And some people talk about entangled states like this as being sort of a biphoton. And so we have these two photons in a sense act as one. So that's certainly the way Schrodinger talks about it in terms of not being a definite state of affairs for both two particles, but there not being a definite state of affairs for each individual particle. And so that's entanglement. And one kind of cool thing about entanglement you'll see later on, most people talk about entanglement between two particles, and you see, there's actually not a limit to the number of particles that can be entangled. So you can have three particles that are entangled with each other, and four particles, or five, and so on. So the largest they've got up to, I've heard about, I think, is getting five photons entangled with each other. So what they're able to get a state, not like this, it gets a little bit complicated more than mathematics, but a state which is a superposition of all five photons being horizontally polarized and all five photons being vertically polarized. And so I think it was done in China, I think that was last year. And certainly you can get three particles entangled, and there are very, very interesting states of affairs called GXS states, Greenberger, Born Zeiner states, where I guess you can have some common source and three photons going out, and you find that all of them are horizontally polarized, or all of them are vertically polarized. But they're in a superposition state of all being horizontal polarized or all being vertical polarized, and it seems as if there's no independent state of affairs before you actually look and before you measure them. And again, analogous to what we saw with the two particles or the two photons, but again, with three photons. And I should say, people also just haven't done this with photons. They've done this with ions, with the singleton charged atoms in sort of electromagnetic cages, electromagnetic fields, if you like. And this, so this is this kind of weird cognitive entanglement I've tried to get across. And the interesting thing about it, you might think, well, that's kind of a strange thing that only exists at a microscopic level. But actually, the world record for entanglements in people in Copenhagen in Denmark in, I think it was 2003, they actually got two clouds of cesium atoms. So cesium atoms, and they got, I think it was, let me see, that was 10,000 billion cesium atoms in one cloud or in an evacuated chamber on sort of one side of their lab. And about a meter away, I think it was, or half a meter, again, 1,000 or 10,000 billion cesium atoms. And now I've actually, to very, very briefly split second, actually get an entangled state between these two clouds of cesium atoms. So they're able to get them in essentially this kind of a state here where they seem to not have any, each individual cesium atom or cloud doesn't seem to have a definite state of affairs. So that's a world record in terms of. In terms of that at the moment. And one interesting thing about entanglement is some people are talking about it as in terms of being a resource, just as you could think of, for example, electricity or gravitational potential energies as being some kind of thing or a resource that you could sort of harness to power cars or to get turbines going, or to actually get basically used for work or some kind of technological purpose. So people are sort of talking about entanglement and strange properties as being sort of like a quantum resource that's sort of fundamentally different, qualitatively different to sort of anything that we encounter in everyday life, anything that we encounter in the world of Isaac Newton. And people are, and this is basically the whole base of quantum computers. So people talk about sort of entanglement as deriving or powering quantum computers. And the tough thing about entanglement is it's just incredibly, incredibly fragile. So it's kind of like a house of cards in a way. And it's just very, very difficult. These clouds of cesium atoms that they have, they can only get them entangled for, it was something like a small split fraction of a second. They just, the problem is, you really have to get them almost perfectly, totally isolated from the rest of the universe to keep things entangled with each other, these cesium clouds. That's why they need to do that in a vacuum. And so this is very hard to keep any air molecules from bumping into them, or any other kind of molecules, to keep them from being heated up. It's very, very difficult to do that. You need to just kind of, I guess, treat them just very carefully, very gently, and really shield them from the rest of the world. So it's very difficult to do. And this is the problem of making entanglement and of keeping it. And this is exactly the problem that people having quantum computers can make. So they've got quantum computers today, but essentially, they only have something like sort of 4 or 5 bits or qubits or quantum bits in them. And so at most, I think they can do something like factors of the number 15. And you don't really need a quantum computer to do that. But in theory, it's fine. So from the theorist's point of view, it works out perfectly. But there's a lot of really, really smart people around the world at the moment that's kind of trying to build one of these big quantum computers. And I'm sure you'll hear about that later on. So we might go to that 5:12, so we might break for lunch. Now, are there any questions? Yes?
Can a photon change its polarization, or is it?
We don't think it can change spontaneously. Well, but if you've got it in a certain, if it interacts with some kind of device like a half-wave plane or something like that, it can change as a result. Of interacting with a crystal or whatever.
Okay. So you can't tell something's entangled if you observe it.
That's a good question. What you do is, that if you make the photons right, or you make the atoms right, or you make the electrons right, they will be entangled. So if you get a laser beam and you shine into one of these calcite crystals or whatever it is in exactly the right way, then you know that some of the photons will be entangled, even though you haven't looked at them. So, yeah. Absolutely. And so what they typically do is, it's kind of like they just do the experiment multiple times, and they don't even see the results where they're not. So even if it just works 1% of the time, or even if this is a really inefficient experiment, it only works less than 0.001, it's still enough. Well,
true assistance. So if it could change the polarization as opposed to tangling, would the other immediately change?
No, it's actually that doesn't happen. So it's kind of a subtle connection. So you might think, well, couldn't I instantaneously change the polarization here, and the other one will change, and therefore I could send a signal faster than the speed of light, or something I could probably change the other one. But it's kind of subtle. You can't actually do that. So if you get two angle photos and you change the polarization of the other one of one of them, the other one is not affected. By that at all. What does happen is if you get two entangled photons and you measure one, that seems to, well, at least there are natural way of thinking about that seems to instantaneously affect the polarization of the old one.
So that lets the altitude.
Sorry?
What's the altitude?
Oh, in quantum computers, you mean? Well, it's kind of subtle. It's hard to find a direct link between the kind of picture we've been talking about here and what we've been doing, but I mean,
maybe that's one for the experts when quantum computing.
But certainly the way, I mean, two answers that quantum entanglement is definitely linked with superposition, and quantum computers seem to be able to do, sort of have not just superposition of two things happening at once, but exponentially many things. That gives you this thing called parallelism. And also something that people say, because you can have these entangled states, you can't have entanglement, you can't get entanglement in Newtonian physics. That allows you just to access, it's almost like this incredibly wider playing field, all these states with these weak topics you just kind of get access to in quantum mechanics. So it's like you're computing on just a great, vastly larger sort of playing field where you're just exploring more and more territory, and that allows you to do computations you couldn't do in other ways. So there's sort of more technical answers, but that's certainly two answers that people talk about. It's lunchtime.